Before we get going, I'd be interested to know what your relationship to poetry is all about. How, anybody here write poems? I'm sorry. God bless you. Get a day job.
Yeah.
Songwriter, you write poems, but you have a music as your delivery system. Yeah, it's a good way to deliver poetry. People will pay for music. Sometimes. Anybody else? What relationship to poetry? Keep talking.
A consumer.
A consumer. We love consumers.
Yeah.
We love consumers who are consumed. Yes. Yeah.
I would say admiration of the poet, because as a small child,
do you have that teacher's address? Because I think one of the American education, there are awful words I could say about its relationship to poetry. More people's feel for poetry is destroyed through education than I think for any other human discipline. I mean, you can probably think of teachers that help. Or threatened your love for poetry, helped either to destroy it or threatened it. And so I think, you know, that you had the desire says to me that you just had to grow. So I would search inside yourself.
I ended up just deciding I was more talented with the prose and I let it go.
Okay, but you're writing.
Yes.
Stay with it. It's a long obedience in the same direction, as Mr. Nietzsche said. Well, for me, it was a matter of back in the, it was the British invasion, you know, the Kinks and the Beatles and the Stones and that first British invasion. And kind of loving the lyrics. And people, I would ask people, yeah, did you hear what he did with those lyrics? No, man, I just heard the song. You know, and it's for some reason the lyrics got me, and then I wanted to write songs, and so I started writing songs when I was in seventh grade, and then it was when I got to high school. I don't know if any of you had an English teacher that required weekly essays. I had an English teacher every Monday. You had to come in, and it was no longer than 2 pages, 1 page minimum. And you come in first thing in the class and you put it on the corner of his desk. He had a little inbox and then he got it back to you 2 days later. He just was big on writing. And I was big on rebellion. So instead of one day, I wrote something that was, you know, I've been working in lyrics, song lyrics, and all of a sudden I wrote something that was not to music. And I kind of liked it. I kind of liked the feeling. But in writing the piece, I never got around to writing the essay. So I typed up the poem and came into class. And you know how you lift up the poem, you shove it in the bottom. I pulled that route. And then I was expecting 2 days later to get this thing back with a little folded and, you know, please do the assignment. Thank you for showing me this, but this is not the assignment. To his amazing credit, this is Dr. David Stevens. He hands it back. It's folded. I open it up, and in the upper right-hand corner, he had written, whenever you want to write a poem instead of an essay, help yourself. Go right ahead. And it was like, permission. It was the opposite of it. Yes. It's one of the reasons why I love teaching.
The difference is your poem was good, and
mine was Oh, no, mine was awful. No, I think there have been 3 really, really good poems, high school poems ever written. And nobody knows what they are. You know, they're just out there. They're lost. Yeah.
Here.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Yeah. Yeah, my interest in poetry started well before my interest in Jesus. I grew up in an Episcopalian household, and poetry and music and loveliness was everywhere. And it came packaged in a New Canaan, Connecticut kind of package. And so I was pretty, at 60s, I was pretty disgusted by it. And there was no room for talking about. It was funny. You could be a consumer, but you should not be a producer, because producers are really sketchy people, and they don't have real jobs. They're lazy. They're no good. But boy, we'll pay a whole bunch of money to hang one of their pieces of art on our wall, you know, that kind of thing. So coming to poetry in junior high school and through high school, it was a closeted activity. You didn't admit, if you were a three varsity sport kind of guy, you didn't admit to your jock friends that you wrote poems. And at home, it didn't happen. But it became something that by the time I was 19, the only ambition I had, this is all BC, before Christ, my one ambition was to write a good poem. If that's the case, you know, number one, you really can't talk about it. At least then, you couldn't talk about it with people you loved. And you knew that you couldn't possibly support yourself. That's not an option. You either have to take up music and become a rock star, or you have to get a day job. Now, if you were born in Ireland, and you were recognized by the state, you'd receive an annual stipend. And it's very minimal, but if you live simply, you could actually subsist as a poet in Ireland. You just have to get on the list. It's a crazy thing. It's almost a disreputable thing. And yet, you know, we like to compliment things by calling, "Oh, that's poetic." You know, it's kind of, anyway. It's a strange relationship our culture has with poetry, and with words. Maybe it's because poetry and fiction also, but poetry in particular, is an ugly art. And what I mean by an ugly art is it's kind of this misshapen thing that appears on a page, and it's black and white, and there's nothing to it. It's not beautiful, unless you're one of those people that loves a typography. And you get off on the shape of letters on the page. Not many people do. It's a real functional thing. Letters on a page, purely functional, is not beautiful. It just is text. It's the ugliest of the arts. It doesn't even have the common sense to go all the way to the margins, right? It's poetry has this issue with the right-hand margin. And it just sits there. It's ugly, It becomes beautiful in the reader. It becomes beautiful if you have a practiced ear when you hear poetry read. It's an ugly art that becomes beautiful in the imagination of the one who attends to it seriously. Which isn't to say that all poetry succeeds in reaching the imagination beautifully. And there's a poem I'll read later that was written sort of, anyway, I'll explain it. But what I'd like to read first going in is a poem, it's the only poem in my life outside of music, outside of song lyrics, that arrived in my life at a point when I was pretty down. I was depressed. I had been laid off from, after 22 years of teaching in a boarding school. I was laid off. I was at a point 9 months later where I worked for a week and I feel like I'd have to sleep for a week. It was miserable. And all of a sudden, a poem arrived in my life, and I honestly don't remember when or how. The circumstances elude me. But this was the one time in my life, and I've been into poetry for a long time, when I would say a poem came close to saving me. And I've heard people talk about how finding poems has saved their life, or you know, that sort of thing. And so I'm going to read this poem just to start off, because it's more than any of the poems I've written, or any of the songs I've heard that I can remember. This poem arrived, and it saved me in that moment. And what's really weird, because I'm not a fan of the Elizabethans, by and large. I'm a monoglot, which means I don't speak other languages, right? And Elizabethan is another language. You need translation, unless you're an English major. And then you learn how to translate, which is really cool. But this is one of William Shakespeare's sonnets. Sonnet number 29. So you want to think of a guy who's been laid off, who's pretty angry at the world. I do self-pity, like, Olympic level self-pity. Okay, and so but this thing arrives, and it was transformative. When in disgrace, with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy contented least. Yet in these thoughts, myself almost despising, haply I think on thee. And then my state, like to the lark at break of day, arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, that then I scorn to change my state with kings. The poem for laid off people. It touches on all the major themes of depression post layoff. Yeah. I recommend that poem only of Shakespeare. Yeah, he's pretty good. After I became a Christian, for the longest time, because I hate religious poetry, by and large, I think it sucks. It's drivel, it's trite, it's garbage, by and large. It's not in a common idiom. It's not in the kind of speech you hear day to day. It's got this kind of fuzzy thing going on, and it's pretty one-dimensional. I went from 1971 to about 1990-something trying to keep theology out of my poetry, because I did not want my poetry to be turned into religious verse. And then I did an MFA at Vermont College, which is not really all that friendly toward Christianity. I mean, there were Christians there, but it was not the kind of thing you'd... There were no fellowship groups, no prayer groups, no worship services on Sunday, which was all fine with me. It was a low residency program, so I didn't have to be there all that long. But one of my very non-Christian advisors, we got into this discussion about religious verse, because I was talking about... we were talking about Paradise Lost, we were talking about some other things, big poems. And I said how much I disliked, generally speaking, religious verse, especially Christian verse. And so we got into it. And at the end, he said, you know, you have to bring those two things together. Your love of writing and your love of theology, that's how he put it, they're obsessions for you. You have to bring it all together. You're not going to write your full thing unless you bring it all together. Poetry, art is about what we obsess over. in large measure. And so began a journey of trying to bring the love of the Lord into, and it, the love of the Lord is always there, but I was just trying to keep the love of the Lord language, Jesus speak, out of it, because it's, the jargon is just so awful. It's hard, this is the most churchy thing I've done in probably 10 years. I've been working in a boarding school, and the whole modus operandi is you got to talk the language of the tribe, and they don't talk like this. They don't think like this. What's going on here is irrelevant there. The issues are totally different. At least they're articulated in a different way. And so you have to learn how to articulate those things. Anyway, I was on Martha's Vineyard. Focus. I was doing some work with Focus. And I went to the used bookstore in Oak Bluffs. What's it called? I can't remember. Anybody remember that? Book Barn? No, Book Den East. Yes, Book Den East. There must be a Book Den West. I was in the poetry section, and I pulled out this book by John Berryman called Love and Fame, which is, all critics say, probably his worst book. He's famous for being both a completely debauched human being for much of his career. He was a drunk. He was a lech. Vachel Lindsay said he didn't have to do any bad stuff because Berryman was doing it all. And all of Berryman's friends just kind of did their awful things through him. He was a miserable human being. He wrote, his main work is called The Dream Songs. They're 365 poems. They're rhymed-ish. Each stanza, three stanza poems, 6 lines per stanza, either 6 or 8 lines per stanza, I'm blanking right now. And the rhetorical strategy that he uses for all 365 poems is the analyst's session, a session with an analyst. So the first stanza is, okay, what do you do when you first, you know, the first phase of a psychoanalytic session? The middle is sort of the where you get down to what's really deep, and then there's this last stanza where you basically begin to unplug and get ready to go about your life. So he's got this rhetorical strategy. He deals with everything. He's drunk when he writes most of it. And finally, he reaches the end of his rope with all of that. So I buy this book. I pick it up. I start to read it, and at the end of it, after you've read about some pretty ridiculous relationships and things that he has, he has 11 addresses to the Lord. And I'm going to read 5 poems from that and then go on from there. Because I want you to... This, in the words of Emily Dickinson, lifted the top of my head off. This said to me that it's possible to write as a believer and not write garbage. Even though the critics don't like this, I think it's because it's so... They don't like it because it's got God in it. These are not titled. I'll just read them. Master of beauty, craftsman of the snowflake, inimitable contriver, endower of earth so gorgeous and different from the boring moon, thank you for such as it is my gift. I have made up a morning prayer to you, containing with precision everything that matters most. According to thy will, the thing begins. It took me off and on 2 days. It does not aim at eloquence. You have come to my rescue again and again in my impassable years, sometimes despairing years. You have allowed my brilliant friends to destroy themselves, and I am still here, severely damaged, but functioning. Unknowable, as I am unknown to my guinea pigs, how can I love you? I only as far as gratitude and awe confidently and absolutely go. I have no idea whether we live again. It doesn't seem likely from either the scientific or the philosophical point of view, but certainly all things are possible to you. And I believe as fixedly in the resurrection appearances to Peter and to Paul as I believe I sit in this blue chair. Only that may have been a special case to establish their initiatory faith. Whatever your end may be, accept my amazement. May I stand until death forever at attention for any your least instruction or enlightenment. I even feel sure you will assist me again, master of insight and beauty. Soul watchman of the flying stars, guard me against my flicker of impulse lust. Teach me to see them as sisters and daughters. Sustain my grand endeavors, husbandship and crafting. Forsake me not when my wild hours come. Grant me sleep nightly. Grace, soften my dreams. Achieve in me patience till the thing be done, a careful view of my achievements come. Make me from time to time the gift of the shoulder, when all hurt, nerves, wine, shut away the whiskey. Empty my heart towards thee. Let me pace without fear the common path of death. Cross am I sometimes with my little daughter. Fill her eyes with tears. Forgive me, Lord. Unite my various soul, soul watchman of the wide and single stars. This next one is the closest he comes to a cliche, probably because we've all heard it before, but I don't know. Perhaps he coined this. Perhaps he just stole it out of the culture that he lived in. But what he does with it, beyond that sort of tiptoeing on the border of cliche, what he goes with it is what's cool. Under new management, Your Majesty, thine. I have soloed mine since childhood. Since my father's suicide when I was 12 blew out my most bright candle, faith, and look at me. I served at Mass 6 dawns a week from 5, adoring Father Boniface and you, memorizing the Latin he explained. Mostly we worked alone, 1 or 2 women. Then my poor father, frantic. Confusions and afflictions followed my days. Wives left me. Bankrupt, I closed my doors. You pierced the roof twice and again. Finally, you opened my eyes. My double nature fused in that point of time 3 weeks ago, day before yesterday. Now, brooding through a history of the early church, I identify with everybody, even the heresiarchs. You know, one of the themes is humility, you know, in this thing, and honesty. He just doesn't see himself on any kind of pedestal, you know. He's smart and he knows he's wrong. As right as he may be, he knows he's wrong. Fearful, I peer upon the mountain path where once your shadow passed, limner of the clouds, upon their fantastic guesses. I am afraid. I never until now confessed. I fell back in love with you, Father, for 2 reasons. You were good to me and a delicious author, rational and passionate. Come on me again, as twice you came to Azarias and Misael. president of the brethren, our mild assemblies inspire, and bother the priest not to be dull. Keep us week long in order. Love my children, my mother far and ill, far brother, my spouse. Oil all my turbulence as at thy dictation I sweat out my wayward works. Father Hopkins said the only true literary critic is Christ. Let me lie down exhausted, content with that. After 50 plus years of crazy, really crazy, wild living, he had this moment that everybody said was entirely fake and that these poems were a joke. The tone is not sarcastic, they're not ironic, and that's kind of, I think, what doomed these poems publicly. He had demons. I mean, the guy had, he had dark history and memory and addictions, and they finally got the better of it. This is not one of those gutter to glory stories. This is more like gutter to the outside, the bridge. And he in Minnesota, he got up on a bridge and he jumped and he killed himself. This is a conference about grace, right? Okay. Thank you. I mean, that's. It's not because we can get our shit together that God saves us. Our shit may kill us. We may perish because of bad decisions, because the demons are just too great, the darkness overwhelming, and we don't have the coping mechanisms or the community to get us through it. It's just the nature of the world we live in. So he jumped. Now this poem is the last of this series, and Just listen to it. It's yeah. Okay. Do you know? I'll shut up. Germanicus leapt upon the wild lion in Smyrna, wishing to pass quickly from a lawless life. The crowd shook the stadium. The proconsul marveled. 86 years I have been his servant, and he has done me no harm. How can I blaspheme my king who saved me? Polycarp, John's pupil, facing the fire. Make me too acceptable at the end of time. I'm sorry, I get really choked up in this poem. Excuse me. I'm going to try that again. Make me too acceptable at the end of time in my degree, which then thou wilt award. Cancer, senility, mania. I pray I may be ready with my witness. Damn. You mistake me for a scholar. This was published in 1970. It's this though right here.
And he died
when? Yeah, later.
No.
There's only one other book of his that was published, and it was published posthumously. Delusions, etc. I beg your pardon?
Isn't there a book called Recovery?
I don't know.
It is a prose.
Yeah, that may be the case. In any case, you could argue whether those are great poems or not, but to me, it's somebody who the only language he had was the language of American culture in the 50s and the 60s, and infused with alcohol and rage and lust and deep cynicism, and yet he was able to find a way to speak. I'm going to read a few of mine from this book. These are poems in conversation with the Psalms, 150 poems in conversation with 150 Psalms. I was going through a transition in my life, and I was looking for a bridge discipline between being a chaplain in a school and being the creative writing teacher. I was putting away formal religious service and moving from being a professional to being an amateur, which I highly recommend. You do it not for the paycheck, but for the love of it. That's really what it's all about, right? Okay, so these poems are the fruit of that discipline, a three-year process of writing a poem a week in response to a different psalm. Now I'll just read a few of these. In the book, there's a scripture verse on the top that is like the triggering verse that when I was reading the psalm, my strategy, the methodology was on Sunday, I would read the next psalm, and I would continue reading deeply and taking notes in my journal. And by Friday or Saturday, my goal was to have a poem drafted and then put it away so that on Sunday I could begin reading the next psalm and then proceed like that. And it worked. And it took 3 years, and I had a couple weeks off. So there's these little verses on the top. From Psalm 24, verse 7. "Lift up your heads, O ye gates. Be lifted up, you ancient doors." The poem is called "Crossing the Williamsburg Bridge." The setting on Easter morning. Walt Whitman's Brooklyn behind us. We are walking to Manhattan. And a late lunch in Chinatown. Steamed dumplings, rooster sauce, pan-fried sesame bread, plastic bowls of spicy mushroom soup, oolong tea. We walk above traffic, the river, beside the JMZ line, share elevated pedestrian lanes with cyclists, Hasidim, speedwalkers, Latinos, hippies, arty types in all black. You are here. A mantra learned from maps on kiosks in suburban malls plays in my head. And softly to myself, I offer up an Easter hymn under Jerusalem blue skies. All families will bow before him. He is the King of Glory. To the south, a thin column of cloud rises like altar smoke. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. In this light, even the jaded skyline stands transfigured. Starting with a couple of New York poems. I have, only because my son lives here, you know. New York, when I was growing up, was always thought is the toilet bowl of the universe. There's a lot of fecal matter everywhere around it and stains and things. And then my son moved in and my heart came with it. And all of a sudden, I was looking at the city from a place of love rather than a place of suburban disdain. Anyway, "Send forth your light and guide me to the place where you dwell." The poem is called "In the New Year." Times Square, Manhattan, 1 million souls assembled, then disperse. And though not everyone's retelling of the event will be disappointment-free, the larger story of so many coming in and going out smacks of a general restraint so glorious one might see God all over it. Yet that weekend, who makes the front page of the Sunday Times but a mouthy teen from Toledo who refused to slip the assistant principal's bowling shirt over her navel-bearing violation of the school code. Mousterion tes anomias, all hell breaking loose in Ohio, of all places. The girl is 14, handcuffed, booked, detained in a holding cell. And whether she passes ninth grade or not, her little story won out over the big story of how tens of thousands of teens in the Midwest managed that day to dress okay, navigate a schedule of major and minor scholastic commitments plus gym, and thus defer busloads of instant gratification in exchange for making slow, quiet gains on any number of American dreams. According to Times correspondent Sarah Reimer, the girl said the bowling shirt was real ugly. True story. I don't know if you remember that. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Hello, America. How are you? I should have mentioned that the Mysteriantes Anomias is the mystery of lawlessness, or it was mentioned earlier in one of the talks. In this poem, the only Greek or funky word is poema, which is the Greek word for masterpiece. So when I tried to understand all this, it was oppressive to me. From Psalm 73, verse 16. The poem is off Jake's Pier, and it's in Fish Point, Maine. North through the square gull-stained arch, lobster boats, terns, cormorants, osprey, the whole confetti-strewn harbor, and above the far rocks, a stunning new camp, senatorial among more representative habitations. Been a few harsh words among longtime locals, Jake one of them, resenting inelegantly how the camp's casual grandeur alters the scale of the entire bay and renders more and more obvious their own home's dull and sagging lines. Yet all this, the point, the harbor, the new camp, inheres from one moment to the next so perfectly, not one atom in the retina of a seal pup ever goes suddenly missing. Why, it almost seems we are living into a prefab universe rising immediately beneath and around us. But more likely, nothing exists even 5 minutes from now. And we, along with all things, are figures in an inscrutable poema that in each instant of becoming is not here, here, then gone. Like a phrase in a jazz improvisation sustained seamlessly over the architecture we call time. And only by what we call mind do we grasp the immense rhythm and craft of its coming in and going out. This is probably the most conspicuously theological poem I've ever written. From Psalm 96, worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness, which is, the beauty of holiness was one of the phrases, growing up in the Episcopal Church, that phrase was one of the phrases that, that kind of stuck to me when I was a kid. And growing up in suburbia where there was the beauty of affluence, I knew that when I heard that phrase, it was talking about something other than what New Canaan, Connecticut defined as beautiful. I didn't know what it was, but I believed in it. And I kind of wanted to find out about it. That was as close as I got to religion, even though I was raised in it. And I was an acolyte and I, you know, all that stuff. So worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness from Psalm 96. The poem is what holds us back. The Lord reigns. Let the earth be glad. And Sunday to Sunday says, it's about a body. Mind house, love pump, engine of desire. Was he or was he not human? Did he or did he not rise from death? Sunday to Sunday, if about nothing else, then a body's flesh, blood, bones, veins, teeth, the whole vast prairie of nerves, topography of parts, seemly and unseemly. Was he or was he not all that we are and more? Beyond merely good, his earth gift being for the body, yours, mine, declares our bodies good beyond imagining. And how we receive it says whether a body having died and changed to be like his body passes on from this thinning coil to that thief-thick paradise where he has gone before and now is. What holds us back? The foolish things we do in the body, always in the body, yielding to lust or anger, the gravities of unbelief, even the least foolish thing. And then in a nod to John Berryman and another one of my favorite poets who have undergone conversion, Bob Dylan. They were both whether sort of adopted sons of Minnesota. So they had this common state in their lives. And in August of 1966, you may know the story, Dylan was out on his motorcycle and had a near-fatal accident. The great album that came on the other side of that accident was Nashville Skyline, where everybody learned, hey, maybe he can sing. Anybody know what kind of motorcycle he rode? No, wouldn't that be great? Yeah, have you seen that movie, The Last Indian? Or The World's Fastest Indian?
No.
Oh my gosh. Anybody seen The World's Fastest Indian? Isn't it wonderful?
Yeah.
Yes. Good God, you've got to see it. Oh. Oh, there's some laugh out loud funny.
Yeah.
Oh dear. And then really deeply serious and moving and wonderful. If you are someone, yes, if you're someone who has given up on something that you once loved as a child, or you have an ambition to do something to the very end and never give up, The World's Fastest Indian. Okay, sorry, no, his was a triumph, which is great because it's one of those words that can do pun duty. Yeah. Okay, so Psalm 146, the Lord sets prisoners free. That was the thing. So what I did was I imagined a conversation. I imagined that after Dylan's accident, there he is in the hospital, wherever he was in the hospital. I don't know that. And so Berryman decided to pay him a visit. So Berryman talking to Dylan, as Dylan is probably, he can't even talk back. He's just there in bed.
Do you mean literally?
What?
He paid him a visit?
In my imagination, literally, he paid him a visit.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
No, this is just my invention. There's a guy named David Wojahn. Anybody familiar with the poetry of David Wojahn? He won the Yale Younger Prize a bunch of years ago. He has a book called Mystery Train. And in that, he has what are called the rock and roll sonnets. You got to get these. They're just amazing. He has imagined conversations between people who never met each other. Like Chuck Berry and, Bill Haley, or something. Or Patti Smith. It's just stuff that's incongruous. It's really crazy. And yet they're really wonderful poems. And it's all sonnets or a sonnet rhetorical strategy. So they may be all over the page, but he would argue that they're in the sonnet strategy. Anyway. So this is a poem that I borrowed that idea, but because it's in Berryman's voice, and you've heard a little bit of Berryman, because it's in Berryman's voice, kind of, I also made it a three stanza, six lines per stanza, so it sort of mimics the dream song. And it's called In the Hospital, Berryman to Dylan, August 1966. I've heard him read. I'm not going to try to imitate him. But when he's drunk, he's terrible. There's a famous one with him and, what's his name, Boston poet Lowell. Okay. He just butchers his poems. It's embarrassing. But anyway, so In the Hospital, Berryman to Dylan. I'm cross, idiot me, with God who has wrecked this generation and your triumph. Is it so wrong to love another's machine? Oh, Minnesota sends best wishes for your speedy recovery. How convenient having God to be cross with, The way I'm crossed with what's-her-name in New York, but neither here nor there. I am easily crossed, too easily seduced. And you, look at you, look at me. Sad prophets of a hip and facile philosophy. But what if what's wrecked weren't by God wrecked? What then? This I know. This I know. Birthed Kunitz was on the date your triumph failed you. And Mussolini. And Henry of Champagne. Each hungry, cold, naked. Lately, the feeling, a better word, please. That you there in bed bruised, I still standing miraculous here. We, beyond complaint, were made for praise. So where to start? You not gone, nor I, nor yet Kunitz. Just fun. How are we doing on time? Where are we? Four thirty, right on the button. But we started late, right?
Yeah.
Anybody want to get up and leave? I won't take it personally, jerk. These are from a new chapbook that came out recently. Self-portrait with disposable camera. And again, I'll begin this. I have a couple of New York poems in here. I rode the subway this morning. I'm going to close with a subway poem. Why not? We're here, right? Anybody know Mako Fujimura? Great painter. Lives here in New York, or maybe in New Jersey, but I don't know. We went and saw an exhibit of his at St. Peter's Lutheran Church years ago on the day that they had a huge snow here, and it was just... It was magical. Anyway, this is called The Exhibit. Over on Lexington, in the glassy foyer of St. Peter's Lutheran Church, four paintings by M. Fujimura. The largest, a two-panel sea of blues and greens, with, faintly, a life-sized quince emerging. Or disappearing. Like the entire New York skyline, in the holiday blizzard we step back into early that afternoon as we head home around abandoned taxis. Pushing through the best of the storm's wind-blown drifts down each unplowed block of the graying city, no more than 10 souls in sight, all boots and mittens, scarves and hats. And finally, above the intersection we call ours, maybe 30 pigeons playing mid-air like children, or bundled tongues of flame not quite ready to complete their ecstatic descent. If I could, I'd paint it, the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. After late Turner, no borders, no date, no discernible time of day, only the relative coordinates. West 51st Street at 9th Avenue. Though really, it could be almost anywhere. This next one comes out of conversation I actually did have with my sister as we were doing the dishes after a Christmas blowout. And I don't think we were doing a very good job of the dishes. At our family gatherings, the wine flows pretty freely, and we were just shooting the shite and making and doing the dishes. Okay, so this is washing dishes after the feast. It frightens me to think, she said, interrupting my holiday banter. Imagining the phrase as antecedent to a rare gift of honest exchange between grown-up siblings, I dashed into the split second of dead air, anticipating silently her elaboration. What a mess we've made of things for our kids. How many parents of starving children must hate us for our amazing prosperity and self-indulgence? But I had misread her punctuation, took the period as a pause, and all at once found myself, like that coyote we used to pull for on Saturday mornings, utterly without purchase, eyeballing an abyss. Which is when, glancing back across the divide of the double sink at her busy hens, I saw her as though she were curled in a ball on the lip of a cliff, knees tight to her chest, face buried in the cotton folds of a holly green dress. "It's okay," I wanted to tell her. "It scares me too." But I was already plummeting, tumbling in free fall to a sun-baked canyon floor, the crazy cur in her endless cartoon of an unreliable universe. Speaking of unreliable universe, it's really hip to be meaningless. It's really hard to write away from meaning. We're meaning-making machines. We make patterns. You know, we just meaning is it's really hard to do it. And I think a lot of the poetry that tries to write away from meaning or just create a what amounts to a meaningless text that you the reader get to make meaning out of if you care to or just enjoy the absurdity of it. I think a lot of it's terrible. I think it sucks. It's boring. It's not gripping. It's nothing you'd memorize in order to get through your day. It's poetry, but I don't think it's important. Some of it might be, but most of it's not, even though it's hip. I tried to write one. This poem is that. And it was actually kind of fun, but it's hard. It's really hard. Try sometime to write away from meaning. Every time you get a word down or a phrase, don't follow meaning. Right away from it. It's a great challenge. So this is a poem called So It Goes. Winter antelopes into erstwhile dogmas committed against an ivory cane. And three ducats of Pilsner can't buy me lust or you levitating with one hand on the other in arcs of unctuous radiator steam falling all over itself like drunken blind luck or a dispossessed Carnegie. Don't get me wrong. Trains are my optimal frame of deference. They're unsung articles gallivanting the Transvaal with brash gargoyles in a grand quartersaun wish to make moguls of slush piles the old-fashioned way by blowing in their alabaster nostrils. And reeking of time, I am here to report that the gossamer intersection of infinite space and your sizzling flywheel has fibrillized a cantaloupe so far out of season only a dissociative lemur would admit to not seeing the humor in it. And were this not the case, dear other, would I have told you? From the meaningless and but fun to something more real. A poem for my wife, What I Answered. It was, of course, the cancer that killed her. She and I were alone in the hospital room. You were at the nurse's station, I think, or in the bathroom or picking up lunch. The sun was bright through the window. We were holding hands, and I had just said something about God or faith, or maybe about Schuller, or catching the closing night of a Graham crusade on the tube. In any case, I had spoken from my love for her, and you know how I loved her, how easily we laughed together. Her next words to me were clear and soft, the tone of her voice natural, even calm. I believe she wanted to know. Am I dying? Yes. It never occurred to me to say anything else. Besides, she could always see through a lie. She looked over at me, then away at the window. Slowly, she closed her eyes, squeezed my hand. No one had prepared me for that silence. I'll never forget the time she told me how she enjoyed bragging to her customers at the laundromat about her daughter being married to a priest, and how it never failed to raise their thick French Catholic eyebrows. I don't remember wearing my collar to the hospital that day, or why I have taken so long to tell you this. She and I sat there in the bright room holding hands. And then finally, step away from the closing door. I want to do that in that radiohead voice. Step away. I can't do it. Anyway, you've heard it. If you've ridden the subway, you've heard it. Step away from the closing door. I don't think the phrase has changed since the last time I heard it. The digitized voice does not threaten, but it is male, imperative, unlike the female voice immediately preceding, softer, knowing both the next and final stops along the subway line. The door will not stand open forever. The train must roll on. Here, under the avenues, the Holy Ghost works overtime, ventriloquist and self-effacing architect of a traveler's peace of mind. And it works. The doors close. The journey continues without incident 1,000 times daily. But you do not have to be, but you do not need to be an habitué of urban bustle to marvel at the grace of deferring to disembodied voices. In rural Connecticut, an hour or so before midnight, a timer turns all intersection stoplights into cautionary blinking ones. And motorists get it. Comply. Proceed. Fini. Thanks for coming around to this. This is great.
Thank you.